Jeff Timmer is former executive director of the Michigan Republican Party. Mark Brewer is former chair of the Michigan Democrats. And this is a republic, if you can keep it, with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
Welcome back to another week of A Republic, If You Can Keep It. Later in the podcast, we'll be talking to longtime national political consultant and Michigan native, Matthew Dowd. But first, let's take a look at the latest in political news.
Well, there's a lot of things that are going to be happening this week. By all accounts, there's going to be some indictment, whether it's the Trump Organization itself, whether it's the organization and some individuals. But let's start with President Biden coming to Michigan to sell the infrastructure deal, as well as solidify his position in a state he won very handily, but was still a competitive state last year.
Yeah, Jeff, I think it's an interesting choice. You know, obviously it's a competitive state, and candidates of both parties, presidents of both parties, are frequent visitors. But it's interesting that he chose Traverse City during the Cherry Festival of all weeks to go up there. Again, a very interesting choice. You know, not the traditional Flint, Saginaw, Detroit area for a Democrat. So it's going to be very interesting to see. I see the governor is going to be with him, and I expect that there'll be a lot of other local Democratic candidates and officials up there. It'll be interesting to see what he says. You know, he could get a lot of attention because it is the week of the Cherry Festival. What do you think? Why is he going to Traverse City?
Well, 9 out of 10 people who are there are probably not from there this week. You know, it's a major tourist a destination, the Cherry Festival. People from all over the state and all over the Midwest are going to be there. So it's not just, you know, from Southeast Michigan or increasingly competitive West Michigan, but it could be people from Chicago area, Chicago suburbs that are traveling up there. Not that Illinois has been much of a competitive state, but Ohio. But it does underscore, too, the fact if you look at the media market spending in the Traverse City DMA over the last many election cycles, it gets a huge disproportionate share of the campaign dollars compared to the population. It's there's a lot of votes for grabs in that area. It's changing and changing considerably, especially the coastal areas, certainly not the rural inland agriculture areas, but the areas that rely on travel and tourism and higher real estate values. Those are people who the last few elections have shown us tend to vote Democrat now. They were Republicans and they're no longer.
Yeah, I know Democrats have long had their eye on that House seat. There was a time a couple decades ago when Democrats had the Senate seat that ran from Traverse City to the Upper Peninsula.
Mitch Irwin.
Right. And I know the local Democrats are very eager for the county redistricting process, because they think they can make some inroads on the county commission. You know, and also President Biden can show his agricultural chops, right?
Sure.
Eat some cherry products. You know, advertise and talk about Michigan agriculture. So there are lots of things that could flow out of this for him.
Well, and I don't know the schedule and the timing of the event, but, you know, they always have like the Blue Angel fly over and all that kind of thing. So, you know, maybe that's going to be part of the backdrop to this. You can't get more patriotic than that on the 4th of July. You know, you've got hot dogs, well, cherry pie, not apple pie, but, it's a bit of Americana in one of the prettiest places in the United States. So it's a smart pick.
Right. Very, very smart pick. Well, let's see what else is going on this week. I know the legislature is trying to wrap up and take July off. They're working on the budget. Ironically, really surprisingly, the House Republicans passed a budget last week, an education budget the governor agreed with, but apparently the Senate did not. We got the voter suppression bills, photo ID specifically up. The House made some significant changes to the Senate package and sent it back over to the Senate. So what do you think is going to happen to the legislature this week?
It's so hard to predict what's going to go down with those guys. I mean, they're not dictated. Normal politics and reason don't seem to dictate their moves. They'll probably try to do something to upstage the governor. I'm not sure what it's going to be, but that's my guess. I'll find it ironic. I wonder if any Republican represented areas were impacted by flooding, because I'll be curious to see if they, you know, are in favor of the governor using emergency powers to bring funding into their districts, because, you know, they wouldn't recognize that that would make them giant dumbass hypocrites. When it comes to the budget, they'll probably think they're more clever than she is and try to pull something rather than just go along. That's my guess. Is there something up their sleeve? We'll find out what it is here in the next couple of days. But I won't be surprised at all to see them come back. Maybe not the week immediately after the 4th, but the following week to try to wrap things up.
Yeah, they're really putting schools in a hard spot because school budgets start July 1. And I know most of them are going ahead and planning based on what passed the House last week. You know, they really, you know, the legislature, unless they do this right, I mean, it could be a win-win for the governor. You know, if the Senate capitulates and this huge education budget passes, she signs it. But if for some reason they don't, it's not on her, it's on them, that the schools don't have the money or they can't plan on the money that they need. Yeah, so I'll be interested to see if the surprise you think may be coming actually comes and what it is that they think they can pull off.
If the last couple of years are a guide, their political calculus with the Republican-led legislature is pretty tone-deaf. They think they're clever. They're playing to a plurality of voters in Michigan, a majority in their primaries, for sure, but they fail to recognize how they're alienating a majority of voters in November elections.
Jeff and Mark will be back after these messages.
Epic MRA is pleased to be a sponsor of this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with decades of experience measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, federal, state, and local issues. Our clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, state agencies, and local governments across the state. When it comes to measuring voter opinions, Epic MRA has been known as the go-to Michigan pollster for over 25 years. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
The Michigan Polycast. It's been called one of Michigan's top political podcasts by Hourly Detroit.
Each week, longtime political junkies Christine Barry and Walt Sorg offer news and views on Michigan politics and policy, as well as national issues impacting our pleasant peninsulas. And they are joined by some of the state's biggest names from government, politics, academia, and nonprofit groups, with an in-depth look at those issues.
Subscribe now to the Michigan Polycast, online at www.michiganpolycast.com.
You know, our podcast has been about the intersection of Michigan and national politics, and with us today is Matthew Dowd, who's from Michigan and has been a key player in national politics for some decades now. So, Matthew, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. We're born and raised in Detroit, so good to be here.
Well, let's start with your reflections on the current situation that we find ourselves in. You know, is the Trump Organization going to get indicted? And then what happens after that, Matthew? What are your thoughts?
Well, so I think we're in as perilous a moment in our country's history as we've been since 1861. So the moment in time, I think, is as crucial as we've ever faced since the Civil War. And I'm not a drama queen, and I'm pretty zen most of the time. So I think that's where we are. And I think that, in my view, the Republican Party is completely captive of an autocratic movement and an autocratic individual. And that's who they are today. On the question of whether or not Donald Trump will be held accountable, I sure hope so. I I am Irish. So I have, in 2004 during the campaign, sort of going to this, where I feel about this, I posted a Yeats poem on my, a line from a Yeats poem on my wall that said, "The Irish have an abiding sense of tragedy, which sustains them through temporary periods of joy." So I hope he is. I want to see it happen. I want to see Donald Trump and his organization held accountable, but we'll see, I guess.
Do you think that would shake this, what seems to be this unshakable, you know, fervor and devotion to him? Or will it, you know, just kind of further the conspiracy theories that the establishment is out to get him, the deep state is after him again? I mean, well, what's your sense of what political impact that might have on his followers?
So I don't think the 80 or 85% of the Republicans who are on board with Donald Trump still, I don't think will be shaken. And I think, as you alluded to, I think they'll use it just as another opportunity to say whatever deep state or they're against us or they've always been against us. So that element, I don't think will be shaken by it. I mean, obviously somewhat depends on, you know, what the charges are and income tax evasion, whatever all the different charges are. But I don't think they're going to move. I mean, if they weren't moved by January 6th and they haven't moved by all of the lies and all of the stuff, I don't think they'll be moved by an indictment.
Yeah. You know, I was one, Mark can attest, you know, about this time last year, started talking about the prospect of violence after the election. And it's not that I was Nostradamus. I just believed what Trump was saying. And I know the people that he was talking to. And so while January 6th was awful to behold, and it was still somewhat surreal, it was easy to see it coming. And I think that the prospect for continued violence is quite large when Trump is indicted, when we get past, you know, August now, when these people think he's going to be reinstated. I just think that the number of people that are out there just kind of poking the bear and keeping the MAGA nation inflamed are just sowing the seeds of discontent. And you said it correctly. We are continue to be at a moment of peril, unlike anything we've seen since the Civil War.
I completely agree with that. I think actually things are worse today than they were before the November election. I actually think they're worse today because permission has now been given for even worse behavior. And that's part of the legacy of Donald Trump that he unleashed in many ways. I call Donald Trump the great revealer because I think he has revealed what we often either painted over or we neglected to look at. He revealed it. And I think ever since Election Day, as you all know, the run-up from Election Day to January 6th and the aftermath of January 6th, the idea that one political party refuses to hold anyone, wanting to hold anyone accountable for what happened, an insurrection at our U.S. Capitol, that permissiveness to allow bad behavior, it's something, all of these things are something as children we learned, you know, you're not supposed to do this, you're not supposed to do this, you're not supposed to do that, you're supposed to be this, you're supposed to be decent, you're supposed to be respectful, you're not supposed to do that. They've just completely taken any guardrail off that behavior. So I agree with you. And you all in Michigan, I'm in Texas now, and we're facing our own awful Republican leadership here in the state. But Michigan has been front and central on the sort of violent upheaval and confrontation that's happened. It happened to the governor. It happened with the people showing up with guns at the Capitol. It happened to the Secretary of State. It's Michigan is one of the key, I think, hotbeds for some of the crazy corrupt behavior that exists among the Republican Party right now.
I'd like to explore what you said there a moment ago, the great revealer. You had a seat at some of the biggest tables in politics over the last, you know, 20 years. When you look back over that time, what indications might you be able to say, aha, the seeds were planted back then? You know, this didn't all start 5 years ago. There were the seeds were there, and Trump was able to, you know, pour some water on some things, a catalyst, if you will, that caused a new trajectory. But, you know, I've had my thoughts on this, but I'd love to hear yours.
So when I reflect back on it, I mean, there was moments I saw that I think like you overcome, but I mean, I saw some things when I worked for Bush, who I, in my view, was a decent person. He made some mistakes. And as you all know, I had a very public break with him over the war and over the country's dividedness. And I broke with him in that very publicly. I had moments of that Bush was able to sort of manage his way through that without, you know, diverting to the craziness of it, but you saw it. And I sort of trace it back, I mean, fundamentally to the mid-90s. I think the rise of Newt Gingrich combined with the rise of Fox News, I think in my view, created this fertile land for this to happen, and they each exacerbated it. And then when Sarah Palin, in my view, when I saw Sarah Palin picked as the vice presidential nominee by John McCain, and then watched her draw bigger crowds as a vice presidential candidate than John McCain did among Republicans, among that sort of same group. She was like the Donald Trump version before Donald Trump. And that's why, I don't know if you remember, that's why in the beginning of September in 2015, I said that I thought Donald Trump would be the Republican nominee. When everybody was like, no way, no way, no way, no way. I said I thought he was going to be the Republican nominee then. Because I knew the Republican Party had become, everybody still thought of the Republican Party, even Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, all of those candidates still thought of as like the country club party. This is who they are. And I knew it was a sort of had become a white grievance party by that point in time, which Sarah Palin appealed to 8 years earlier. And I thought there is no way they're going to nominate sort of a traditional Republican because that's not who they are anymore. And Donald Trump, give the guy credit. Donald Trump recognized what the Republican Party had become long before any of those office holders recognized what the Republican Party had become.
No doubt about it.
Yeah, I mean, but we find ourselves in a very difficult situation. I mean, the two political parties, because of the laws and customs and culture, are basically kind of locked in place. It's very hard for a third party or even a split in a major party to succeed. Now, you made a great analogy earlier, Matthew, to the Civil War, right? Where we had four parties. The country was split four ways, and we all know what happened after that.
Yep.
This is a question Jeff and I have asked repeatedly over the last several months on this podcast. It's like, you know, where do we go from here? I mean, we had Bill Kristol on the show, and he said, look, Republicans who are reasonable, they should be supporting Biden to the extent that they can. You know, others like Jeff and others have sought a different path with the Lincoln Project and so forth. So what is your vision about how to fix this?
So that's a great question. And I think all of us have spent a lot of time thinking about it. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about it from all sides of this. And I have come to the place that Liz Cheney is not going to fix what the Republican Party is. She's gone. She's a unicorn in the Republican Party. She's not what the Republican Party is. You're not going to fix the Republican Party. The only way the Republican Party will fix itself is if they suffer devastating losses in multiple elections. They have to lose, and they have to lose badly, and then they may finally say, this was a bad direction, we're going to change, or we're going to do something differently. If they don't suffer serious repercussions at the ballot box, there's no incentive other than the right thing to do, which doesn't seem to be an incentive anymore for them. That's the only way. And if I were the Democrats, if I were giving advice to the Democrats, which I would love to do because I want the Democrats to win up and down the ballot for numbers of elections so we can excise this cancer, is I would start trying to recruit, this is my view, former Republicans and people to run as either moderates or conservative Democrats in red jurisdictions. That to me, people that believe in democracy, people that believe in some fundamental things the Democratic Party does, they may disagree on some other things. But if the Democratic Party really wants to contribute to fixing this problem, they should welcome with open arms candidates that may not completely fall in the same pedigree, but basically would be able to win in red areas, and not sort of get into this battle of like, well, they're good on only 8 of 10 issues. They're not right on 2 of the issues. If they support democracy and they want to fix this problem, I think Democrats, especially in red areas, should go out of their way to recruit those people and see if they can get him on the ballot and start taking back some of the red spots in the country.
That's great advice.
It is great advice. And, speaking for my party, unfortunately, we fall into that a lot, where we insist that everybody be a purist and there are litmus tests. I mean, it happens in both political parties. But you're right, Matthew. We've got to rise above that, because this is an existential crisis for democracy. And we've got to be bigger than that as a political party. But that's a sound approach that you outlined there.
And, then as you guys know, there's places in Michigan, the Upper Peninsula, Northern Michigan, there's places in Michigan that for the right kind of candidate that didn't have to sort of go through that, maybe, as I say, on fundamental values is the same as the Democratic Party on some fundamental values, but may diverge on some things. I mean, that's the way to win those areas. And then once you win those areas, it makes the Democratic Party more able to play in all of these places. And then it causes the Republican Party to reflect on themselves finally. So that's what I would do. And I think there's a number of people out there. I think there's a number of former Republicans and independents that voted for Biden, but don't consider themselves Democrats today, but know how bad the Republican Party is, still feel like they don't have a family to go to. And if the Democratic Party went out of their way to sort of say, hey, we want you, and especially in these red areas, Tennessee, Texas, Alabama, Mississippi, parts of Michigan, parts of Wisconsin, part Ohio, Iowa, it would, I think, be such a great thing to do for the country. If we could put our tribal allegiances behind and say, let's do it for democracy. That, to me, is the path out of this. And I hope the Democratic Party, especially at the state level, starts doing that.
You know, I think that's I agree that that's a path. I think it's a challenging path given, in Michigan, as you know, Matthew, we have straight party voting, which is very popular. And people have tremendous allegiance to their party. And it would take a real brave Republican, either a current office holder or a former office holder, to take that leap in some of these areas and run as a Democrat. But they certainly can't succeed without the support of an institutional party like the Democratic Party as they make that jump.
Not to interrupt, Mark. I've been thinking about this, and I'm going to. I went and drove to 2 hours from here to speak at a rally that Beto O'Rourke did. And I sat down, met with him, and he said, come speak at it. So, I got up there as the former Republican and said, democracy is too important for us to like, and people loved it. And, and of course it got some play because like Dowd showed up at a Beto rally or whatever. And I told the Democratic Party here, I said, listen, invite me to I'm happy to show up at anything, any meeting, anything, to do whatever I can to convince people how bad this is. And the only way to fix this is to this route. So I think, and Beto was actually smart enough. The good thing about Beto, he's smart enough to recognize. He was recognized. That's like the smart move, especially if he ever wants to run, to not be branded. I actually think it helps the progressive candidates. Interestingly, it helps the progressive candidates on the ballot because it makes it harder for the Republicans to call them all socialists. We got former Republicans running.
Right. Now, I think what you said earlier about the Republicans, we certainly can't rely on their conscience or their character to
know
themselves. It needs to be a series of devastating losses. And, I've had some disagreement with my friend John Kasich on this. He very visibly supported Joe Biden, spoke at the Democratic convention, but still calls himself a Republican and urges, support of other Republican candidates down ballot. And that's where I think, that's where I disagree with John, with many others who have this, I think, a naive view of what's really at stake here and what's going on and what it's going to take to fix it.
I think that's a really good point. I was on CNN with John and I did the same thing. I was like, John, what you're talking about, why don't we dig up a dinosaur? Because that's what you're talking about, because what you're talking about doesn't exist anymore. Bipartisanship is like a relationship, and I love bipartisanship and I'm all for it. But bipartisanship doesn't work when you don't trust and your partner lies to you.
we can't worry about, you know, working on, you know, one day on rural broadband, for an example, while one side is trying to subvert democracy and we take this lurch toward autocracy. The two just aren't compatible. You know, right now, policy issues, even something as large as the infrastructure, and Joe Biden's going to be in Michigan this week touting the infrastructure package. And, you know, I really think until they can deal with issues as fundamental as voting rights, that the bandwidth they're devoting to traditional policy is misplaced and it's not advancing what really needs to be advanced. If we're worried about, you know, shovels in the ground and building new roads, that's going to be great. When the autocrats take over, they'll have brand new roads to drive their tanks across.
Yeah, well, I said, I don't know if you saw the tweet I wrote yesterday. I said from 1933 to 1945 in Germany, the infrastructure was completely rebuilt and the economy boomed and they lost democracy. So that, I mean, that's a fact that, and that happened. And my only, I mean, obviously we all need infrastructure improves, our roads, our bridges, everything is falling apart. We need it absolutely improve as a functioning democracy and a functioning economy. But my fear in this is Republicans are going to be like, well, we did that, so why do we need to do anything on vote? Like, we did that, everything's okay. It sort of like gives them permission slip to wreck the big thing because they did this other thing. That's my fear.
Sure. And I fear that, like, the presser that they had at the White House last week announcing the infrastructure deal is going to somewhat be akin to Bush's mission accomplished moment. The fact that, well, but that they went out and touted this deal and they're slapping themselves on the back. But the ability of Mitch McConnell to scuttle that deal in the Senate is tremendous. And the announcing it as fait accompli before it really gets out of the gate, I think, is really underestimating the pressure that McConnell can exert upon five of those 10 Republicans.
So I would give one piece of advice I would give to the Democrats on the voting rights stuff, which obviously everything the Republicans are doing is awful and putting impediments in place and restrictions and all that. It's obviously horrible. But I think I think the conversation needs to be raised up one notch so that it'll appeal to more than just Democrats and more than just Democratic-leaning independents. And I think the way to do that is to make it about what they're trying to do is take any way they can be held accountable away from you, right? So you may agree or disagree with this, but by doing this, they're basically giving themselves permission to do all these other bad things that they want to do, and you can't hold them accountable because the only way you can hold them accountable in America is with the vote. And they're just trying to take accountability away to be able to do all of their corrupt, craven things they want to do.
You know, I want to disagree a little bit with both of you on this approach. I think Democrats have to multitask, frankly. I mean, I do think they need to, you know, show some accomplishments like infrastructure and so forth. But at the same time, I agree with you both that there's an existential crisis when it comes to democracy. But I think if they solely focus on that, you know, I just very worry about their electoral prospects next year, that's not going to be enough to take back to the public in a midterm for them to succeed. Because, again, we all agree the last thing we want is for the Republicans to succeed. We had Congressman Kildee on a few weeks ago, Matthew, and he said, you know, from what he could tell, McCarthy and the rest of them are just doubling down.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. And he said, we cannot permit that to succeed. And so I think, again, I think Democrats have to kind of multitask here, as difficult as that is. And I understand, you know, it's a strong criticism that they're not paying enough attention to these democracy issues. But I really do believe that they need to do both. I think we need, and I'm just going to say we as Democrats need to be able to show to the American people next year that we can get some stuff done, even if we do it by ourselves.
Right? Mark, I don't disagree with you at all about that. My only criticism is I think that we need an infrastructure thing, and I think you're right. The American public wants stuff actually done. But I think they need to, like, every day, if they do an infrastructure thing the same day, they need to do a democracy thing. So I think they need to, and they need to couple the two things. They need to couple the two things together. Because, like, while we're repairing infrastructure, we need to repair the infrastructure of democracy. While we're doing this, and my fear is they, you know, name Kamala the you know, democracy person, and then we don't hear about it for 3 days, and then all of a sudden something comes up, and they, and so I agree with multitasking, but the thread line ought to be, the thread line through all of it ought to be our infrastructure of our democracy.
Yeah, that's a great one. And, you know, I think you're right. I mean, I think of the Democratic leaders, Nancy Pelosi's done the best job of that.
I agree completely with that.
You know, she announced that we're going to have a select committee on the insurrection, even if
completely agree with you.
Right. But Biden has chosen a different path of, you know, for whatever reason, right or wrongly, you know, he's resisting what he thinks is relitigation of the past. And, you know, Chuck Schumer, I think, can do a much better job on this democracy issue as well.
I agree with that.
We'll see how it plays out. I hope he will continue to bring up, you know, the Voting Rights Act, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act renewal, et cetera, and keep the pressure on that front while they're trying to do the infrastructure piece as well.
I agree with you. I agree 100% with you.
I'm going to ask you to gaze into your crystal ball, Matthew. You and I intersected, gosh, 15 years ago now when Dick DeVos ran against Jennifer Granholm when she was seeking re-election. And the reason I bring that up is because I've noticed over the last week on Facebook that Betsy DeVos is now showing up at all kinds of rural county GOP events. And I'm wondering what's getting her out into the hustings here. What could be looming? You know, the thought of, you know, Betsy kind of doing an encore run for office herself after the Trump administration kind of seems far-fetched to sane observers. But I wonder if it seems far-fetched to her or other Republicans in this day and age.
I don't think anything seems far-fetched to Betsy DeVos. And I think she, if she wanted to run, for something, she could easily win the Republican primary because of where she is and where she's been and her service to the President Trump in all of this. I think Dick, as you probably all know, probably doesn't want anything to do with any of it. Sour taste in his mouth after 2006 or whatever. But Betsy, you know, it's her reason for existence is to get up every day and, you know, and I'm sure she's going to be 100% trying to defeat the three main statewide office holders in Michigan, the governor, the attorney general, and the secretary of state. But who knows? I have no idea. But if she wanted to run and she'd win the Republican primary. She definitely, I don't know if she could win a general election. I think she's got a hell of a lot of baggage.
Agreed.
But she could win the Republican primary.
And I imagine she has the self-awareness to recognize the drag that would be in November, but it would be a gift to the Democrats. It would be a gift to the scenario that we talked about, that the Democrat or the Republicans need to suffer devastating losses, because I think she could help deliver that.
You know, Jeff, I had not seen or heard that about Betsy DeVos. Do you think both of you think she could take on who seems to be the darling right now and beat Police Chief Craig?
My guess is, as the Republicans do in Michigan, Mark, and you know this very well, they have a tendency to do stuff behind the scenes to clear candidates from the field when they want to do that. They have seem to have a way of doing that, and it usually ends up being some check or some way to do that. So I'm not convinced that if she decided to do that, that she couldn't clear the field by doing, you know, something behind the scenes.
Maybe she puts Craig on the ticket, Lieutenant Governor, right?
Yep.
Well, she's one of the only people who has the ability to stand up to Ron Weiser with a bigger checkbook.
Yeah, that's very true.
Well, we are out of time for this week. Our great thanks to Matthew Dowd for lending his insights into the conversation.
And my thanks also to Matthew. Thanks for being with us and thanks for your insights.
Thank you, guys, and good luck. And we're all on the same team, so we all want the same thing.
As always, your comments on the podcast are encouraged. The email address is comments@arepublicpodcast.com, or you can add your comments on our Facebook page.
If the Republic is still standing, and that's always a question in today's politics, we will be back in a week. I'm Jeff Timmer.
And I'm Mark Brewer. We'll see you in July.
You can subscribe to A Republic If You Can Keep It, wherever you get your podcasts, or on our website, arepublicpodcast.com. A Republic If You Can Keep It, with Mark Brewer and Jeff Timmer, is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.